From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, the science of happiness, loneliness, and depression among the elderly. First, we'll talk with Jennifer Margaret of Iowa State University about a program developed at ISU that helps identify what predicts happiness and long life in centenarians, as well as what causes depression in 80-somethings and above. Then a conversation with Daniel Russell. Since the early 1980s, he and his wife, who are both professors at Iowa State University, have been studying loneliness. They developed a loneliness scale, which continues to be cited by researchers and journalists as the approved measurement tool on loneliness. That's all coming up. First, a look at the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we explore the science of happiness, loneliness, and depression among the elderly, especially. Later, a conversation with Daniel Russell. Since the early 1980s, he and his wife, they're both professors at Iowa State University, have been studying loneliness. In fact, they've developed a loneliness scale that is used widely. That a little later in the hour. First, though, other researchers from Iowa State University's gerontology program have helped identify what predicts happiness and long life in centenarians, as well as what causes depression in 80-somethings and above. Joining me to discuss this, Jennifer Margaret, an assistant professor of human development and family studies from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Good afternoon to you.
Oh, good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
I am fine. And tell us about this. This is the work at ISU's gerontology program you're involved with, looking at two tracks, as I understand it, what predicts happiness and long life in those over 100, also what causes depression in those over 80. Now, what do we know about the answers to those two questions in a nutshell?
Well, in a nutshell, it all depends on how you look at it from the older adult's point of view and also who you know. So very much perceptions of the older adult in terms of their life, their functioning, how they view the world relates to their feelings of depression and to their ideas about happiness.
Mm-hmm. So give me an example of a perception that would lead to an unhappy existence.
Well, this is a collaborative group effort with Peter Martin and some others from the Georgia Centenarian team. We've looked at multiple dimensions of how older adults view their lives. And it depends if you're a 60-year-old, an 80-year-old, or a centenarian. How do you view your functioning? And for a 100-year-old who may be undergoing some very difficult kinds of situations, may have limited mobility, may have some chronic health conditions, they may look at that but still figure, well, things could be worse, or look at my neighbor. Versus if that was happening to a 60 or an 80-year-old, they might not view that so positively.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's all relative, and then your perception of it, as you mentioned before. So the predictors of happiness would be?
Basically, how satisfied are you with your life? How congruent do you think your life is now compared to what you did before? Eric Erickson used to talk about integrity versus despair. Do you feel like you've lived your life with integrity and you can look back and say, it's been a good life and I'm happy with where I am? One of the other researchers on our team, Alex Bishop, also found that the availability of social partners and provision. So if you have people in your life that you can talk to, rely on, that's also a major contributor to happiness.
Mm-hmm. I've heard gratitude lines up perfectly almost with happiness. The more grateful you are about your life, and this goes along with just another way of what you said earlier, isn't it? That you could be in a worse off position.
Yes, exactly. Do you appreciate where you are? Do you appreciate where you could be and see the advantages to what you've done and continue to do? Very much. That reminds me of religiosity or spirituality, and oftentimes that is very important for older adults as well.
Okay. I want to reach out to our listeners now this half hour with Jennifer Margaret of Iowa State University to ask our listeners to chip into our conversation. If you, as an older American, could pass on one nugget of wisdom about leading a happy life, what would it be? Think about that and give us a ring. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.com. www.happiness.org. Perhaps you were very unhappy at one point in your life, and then you discovered something that turned your life around, gave you a different perception. Perhaps that's all that was needed. Tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Let's turn to depression. This is where you were the lead author, the part of this study, this program on depression. What causes generally depression in those over 80? And we're talking clinical depression, right?
We're talking depressive symptoms, and that's a very good point to mention. When we're looking at research, typically researchers are not interviewing people in a clinical role. So we're not there to diagnose depression, but think about relative symptoms of depression. Is it one symptom, two symptoms, 15 symptoms of depression? So that's usually how we think about it. What are the behaviors that someone might report related to depression? Mm-hmm. Are they withdrawing from activities? Is there a change in their sleeping or eating pattern? Have they lost interest in social relationships? And those would be some worry points.
Mm-hmm. So if you are the son or the daughter of someone, an elderly person, who suddenly cuts off activities with the normal social group, loses appetite, that would be certainly reason for concern.
Yes, most definitely. And also the other difficult point is as people age, we typically have several things happening or could be happening. I did want to say that depression is not a normal part of aging, nor is cognitive impairment. But often these are things that people worry about, and there's also a social stigma. So if you do notice some changes in behavior, that's something to talk about with the person, something they should talk about with their primary providers. But depression is not normal. Cognitive impairment is not normal.
When you say cognitive impairment, we're talking dementia.
Dementia, memory problems, not being able to recall names, not being able to recall appointments, turn off the stove, having a change in decision-making. There are normative changes in terms of mental health and cognitive functioning, but impairment is not the norm. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an important point for your listeners, that not to accept those changes as normative. And oftentimes it's providers and the older adults themselves who really think, this is a normal reaction. I've had a lot of loss or change in my life. This is to be expected. But really, it's not.
Mm-hmm. And would it be true that allowing it to be normal in your mind, accepting it as normal, means that you slide further down or endanger yourself?
Very much. And research shows that depression is related to many outcomes in everyday functioning and even mortality. It can affect people's recovery from illness, say a heart attack, for example.
Okay. You mentioned stigma. Stigma is always a part of the topic when we talk about mental health issues. How much of a factor is stigma when it comes to older Americans, and what areas of mental health are most stigmatized?
Well, I think the term mental health in general is stigmatized. I believe things are changing. So with current cohorts or generations of older adults, I think this is getting better. And anecdotally, we had a chance to chat on the phone earlier. And I was telling you about a senior health fair. And in the areas that I study of mental health and particularly cognitive functioning, both of those tend to have a great deal of stigma, particularly if we're looking for research participants and we say cognitive abilities or memory. People run. The same with mental health. But interestingly, at the senior health fair, I saw just the opposite. There was a screening room that said depression and anxiety screening, come here. Cognitive screening, memory screening, this other room. And people were very reluctant to go to the cognitive screening, but this particular group, surprisingly and to their credit, was very willing to go and talk about depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Why would the difference be there in the terms of the stigma, the dementia versus the depression?
Well,
anxiety.
That's a good question. I think our society is doing a better job of talking about mental health as a lifespan issue. So this isn't just an issue for older adults. So I think we're doing a better job. I think in terms of cognition, it's related to independence and any kind of admission that someone's having a memory problem or difficulty thinking, problem solving, they're slowing down. That could be seen as a sign of, well, we need to take the keys away, or, oh, this person can't live on their own. And that's not the truth, but I think that's what people fear.
So what should you do if you have an elderly person in your life or you are that elderly person and you notice things changing cognitively,
mm-hmm.
what do you do?
That's a very good question. We often are very good judges of our own mental health, cognitive functioning, as are people in our lives. So if you're noticing those changes, you're getting feedback from other people, talk to your provider. There are also some resources online at some different national sites. But the main thing is to pay attention to where you started, your own baseline, talk to your provider, and find out what's normal for you. And so a little bit of change in terms of cognition, slowing down, some changes in memory, those may be normative, but impairment, forgetting the people in your life, forgetting major things, that's not normal, and that's where someone would need to talk to their provider.
Reaching out to our listeners in this conversation with Jennifer Margaret of Iowa State University as we talk about happiness and depression among the elderly. Reaching out to listeners, if you could pass on a nugget of wisdom about leading a happy life on into your golden years, what would it be? 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Connie wrote us an email just a moment ago. Jennifer, she writes that her father, who just turned 80 years old, is dealing with depression. His doctor advised him to avoid daydreaming. Is this true? Can letting your thoughts roam lead to depression, asks Connie.
Well, I've not talked to Connie or her father or the provider. I don't see anything wrong with daydreaming, thinking about creative aspects, thinking about your life, reminiscing. That in itself would not be, in my view, harmful.
Mm-hmm. And it fits in with the having a healthy perception, feeling of accomplishment in the life that you led up to that point leads to happiness. So daydreaming about the time you had a great mountain climb or hike or camping or whatever you did in your life, right?
Exactly. And that's some of the work that Alex Bishop has done, showing very much that same. If you can look back and you feel happy about those events and those accomplishments, that makes you feel better about where you are.
1-866-780-9100. Looking for nuggets of wisdom about leading a happy life into your golden years. 1-866-780-9100. Randy joins us from Iowa County. Good afternoon, Randy. What have you got? What have you got for us, sir?
A friend of mine from Des Moines died about 5 years ago, and this is a little non-sexual, okay? He says, "I hope you can as long as you want to, and want to as long as you can, but take that any way you want to." Now, for him, that was playing the guitar and chewing on my ear and other people's ears. And this old friend of mine died about 7 years ago. He said somewhere between graduating in high school and ending up in the nursing home, go see Banff, Yellowstone, Crater Lake, go fishing, enjoy things, because when you can't anymore, you'll still have those memories.
Randy, that's a great little anecdote here. Let me turn to Jennifer Margaret, because as you get older, you may lose the ability to do something you've loved all your life. What then, Jennifer? What course of action?
I think that's a great question. And really, it's being flexible with your goals. And so someone who maybe was a marathon runner throughout their life, but they've had some issues with mobility and physical functioning, maybe that's not a possible goal. But running a shorter distance, coaching other people. So if you keep the same priorities and you really focus on what you want to do, you can still find ways to reach toward those goals and to help other people perhaps as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last speaker spoke, the last call-in spoke about some interesting points related to hospitalization, living in an institution. It's when people feel out of control that they typically feel more unhappy or more depressed about things. And so, again, if they can prioritize, think about maybe smaller goals, different goals, working with other people, having different means to accomplish their goals, even if they are in a setting or in a situation that feels a little bit more restrictive or things are out of their control, doing things to kind of promote that sense of control can help.
Okay, let's go to Michael in Muscatine. Michael dialed 1-866-780-9100. What's your secret to happiness on into the later years of our lives, Michael?
Yeah, I've been finding that the more I give, the more enjoyable life is. As we take the journey through, when we can be of service to others in what we do through recognizing when people are in need and recognizing that we can make a difference in people's lives. It's just such a joy mm-hmm. every day to get up and realize that we can make a difference in other people's journeys. And I think it's just so rewarding.
And Michael, may I ask what you do in particular in terms of giving, volunteering?
Well, I do mission volunteering, but I also do within the community with the food pantries and within our area, flood relief in Cedar Rapids. Then we volunteer as ushers at various venues. And just being out and about where we can serve others, the food banks.
Michael? Thank you, Michael, for that from Muscatine. So what is that, Jennifer Margaret, about giving, volunteering, that leads most of us to a sense of satisfaction and happiness?
Oh, I think that's great advice. It's a wonderful piece of wisdom. I think it's a two-way street. As we help other people, we help ourselves. We recognize our own strengths and what we can give. We also learn a great deal from other people. And I think our society is doing a better job, say, of working together. Some interesting research and service outreach that's even happening here at Iowa State relates to intergenerational relationships. How can we connect younger adults with older adults? What can they learn from each other?
Mm-hmm. What kinds of inroads have we made in diagnosing and treating, back to the depression, depression among older people?
We've done a better job, I'd say, in the last 15 years or so. Providers have recognized that older adults may exhibit depressive symptoms a little bit differently than younger adults would. We've done a better job of training practitioners to even understand more about the aging process and what could be typical or atypical. And I think one important thing to remember is that as a group, older adults are very diverse. And what may be typical for one older adult and in their normal realm of functioning may not be true for another older adult. And so groups like the American Psychological Association have been training practitioners, coming up with guidelines, particular assessments. So a depressive inventory, a scale to measure symptoms that works for a 20-year-old may not be appropriate for an 80 or a 100-year-old. Mm-hmm. And that's what some of our research finds. What's predictive of happiness or depression at 60 may not hold for the 80 or the 100-year-old.
Of course, when you get into your later years, you might have to move out of a home that you've lived in for decades, move into assisted living or a nursing home. What about living in nursing homes and such facilities creates happiness and satisfaction? What have we learned there, and what is still there in some of these homes that leads to depression?
Well, I think isolation, and so that will segue to our next speaker. But thinking about loneliness versus the social resources that you have, is someone calling you? Using technology, that's been a major area of growth. Can you Skype with your grandchildren? Are you emailing? So ways to stay connected with people, and going back to that idea of giving, ways that you can give even if you're in your own home or in a nursing home. So you may not be physically with someone, but you can be there in other types of ways.
I hadn't thought about that, but now are nursing homes incorporating Skype and similar
technology?
They
are, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so Skype, smart home technology, whether that's in the nursing home or in the residence. We're doing a project with WE, and so that has a dual benefit. We're getting older adults to cognitively engage in the WE, and also they're engaging with younger adults that are working with them. So I think that's a very promising avenue.
Okay, let's go to Tom in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Tom. Welcome to our program.
Yes, good afternoon. I had a nugget of wisdom for those who are Christian, those who believe that you can distinguish between what human beings want and what God wants. And my nugget is, obviously, to learn to make that distinction. So often we do things just because other people do them. And that should not be our source of authority. Our source of authority is God. And to know what God wants it's primary.
It's brought you happiness, Tom. Let's talk to Jennifer, because earlier in the program you mentioned religion and faith as being a key to happiness for many people. Generally speaking, faiths bring us happiness. Why? Whether we're Christians or Muslims?
I think it speaks to what the caller mentioned. So thinking outside yourself and maybe your own worries, your own concerns, thinking about a larger purpose, reaching out to others, finding some solace in that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us some of the surprises. You've been researching happiness, depression among this age group. Have you run it? What have been the biggest surprises that you've run into?
How much all of the dimensions of our life work together. And that would be some nuggets of wisdom I might pass on, but thinking holistically about ourselves. So spirituality, as we've mentioned, engaging with other people socially, diet, exercise, all of those aspects of our life and functioning really work together. And so more and more research is coming out to show us that if we're taking care of our bodies, it's helping our mind, it's helping our brain. And so just how interconnected aspects of our lives really are.
Okay. When you look 10 or 20 years down the road, what would you hope to see in terms of shifts, greater changes, learning in terms of avoiding depression, increased happiness as we get older?
Again, it would go back to diagnosing, taking away that stigma related to mental health. One thing we haven't talked about is that depression is a risk factor for suicide. And proportionately, older adults are at a higher risk than we might think. They make up about 12% of the U.S. population, yet they make up 16% of suicides.
Mm. What about Iowa in particular, one of the states with the most centenarians? What explains Iowa being at the top of this list?
You and I talked about prior, Iowa is one of the oldest states. We're about third in the nation. We do have an Iowa Coalition on Mental Health and Aging that's looking at ways that nursing home providers, psychologists, physicians, state officials, that we can actually do a better job of making mental health a part of assessment. We can do a better job in terms of treatments. And so they're really looking at ways that we can work with psychotherapy, medication. We can think about individual situations and how to help the older adults. They ranked us at about 49th in terms of access to mental health care in the state.
Okay, Jennifer Margaret, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Iowa State University. Thank you for joining us, Jennifer.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure, Ben.
And when we come back, we'll dovetail this conversation into another about loneliness among the elderly, a new AARP survey published in the current issue of the magazine put out by AARP found that millions of older Americans suffer from chronic loneliness. Coming up, we'll talk about the UCLA Loneliness Scale, which was developed by a pair of researchers who are now at Iowa State University. We'll talk with one of them, Daniel Russell, about the causes of loneliness when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News.
Look at all the lonely people. Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there.
So glad to have you with us on this edition of The Exchange. Over the noon hour, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's holiday travel season, which often means a hotel stay for you, perhaps for visiting relatives. What about these reports we've been hearing of bed bugs, bed bug infestations? Places like Ohio and New York City have been reporting them. Are bed bugs in Iowa, too? Well, next time on The Exchange, tomorrow at this time, we'll find out when we talk with entomologist Ken Holscher and Tom Wickham from the Iowa Department of Public Health. Also tips tomorrow at this time about preventing a bed bug infestation. The Exchange, tomorrow, Tuesday. Today, we're talking about the science of happiness, depression, and loneliness among the elderly. And to continue our discussion, I want to talk about an AARP survey. Some people feel loneliness most acutely during the holidays. A new AARP The magazine survey, published in the current issue of the magazine, found that millions of older Americans suffer from chronic loneliness. Among the sample of over 3,000 people over the age of 45, 35% were found to be chronically lonely, according to the UCLA Loneliness Scale. That's a scale that was developed by a pair of researchers who are now at Iowa State University. Daniel Russell is an Iowa State professor of human development and family studies. His wife, Carolyn Catrona, is a professor and chair of psychology at Iowa State University. And Daniel Russell joins us for the rest of the hour. Good afternoon, Professor Russell.
Good afternoon.
I want to reach out to our listeners right now. If you're one of the millions of Americans who suffer from chronic loneliness, tell us your story. For someone who's never experienced it, what is it like to be lonely all the time? We'd like to know. How do you cope as well? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email, if you prefer that. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Daniel, you and your wife began studying loneliness in the 1980s. Tell us why.
Part of what we were interested in at that time, and quite frankly, we were both in graduate school, was in general looking at interpersonal relationships, what people got from relationships, what happened if they did not have the types of relationships that they wanted. And that led us to look at loneliness. What we found there initially was with college students at UCLA, you know, very high levels of loneliness. And in particular, when students would start college, you would see high levels of loneliness. And then over their first year, they would generally adapt, make friends, and so forth, and loneliness would go down. So it was clear that that loneliness was an important issue.
Mm-hmm. So relationships is a key here. And explain the difference between being alone and being lonely.
Well, for one thing, you know, some people can be alone, socially isolated, and not feel lonely. Other people can have, say, lots of close friends, yet report high levels of loneliness. And what seems to be important is, you know, a number of things. For example, you know, what is the person used to? You know, if you're used to having a lot of social contact, and then you move to a new setting where you don't, you know, that can create a form of loneliness that hopefully is lasts only a short period of time as you develop friendships. Also, it's true that, you know, particularly with what we saw with older college students, you know, they may have lots of friends, but what they really want is a close romantic relationship. And that may lead to a form of loneliness that's termed emotional loneliness. And again, you know, they may have lots of people to do things with, but particularly as they get older and, you know, they are close to the point when they're going to be leaving college, that becomes a key issue.
So it's interesting that you say that someone can be surrounded with other people, have a lot of social relationships, and still be lonely. So it really depends on the need, the type of social relationship you're needing. You can be surrounded by people, and if they're not, what, connecting with you in a certain way, you can feel that it's, what, superficial or off the mark,
that,
or what?
That can certainly happen. One interesting thing in the AARP survey was that one of the things that related to loneliness was the number of people that the individual had met online, you know, through the internet. And the more people they had met in that way, the higher their level of loneliness.
Interesting. We want reaching out to our listeners this half hour for your stories, your questions about loneliness, chronic loneliness suffered by millions of Americans, your questions about it, your experiences, if you'd like to share. 1-866-780-9100. Coping mechanisms would be a good thing we'd like to learn about, too. Elmer is joining us from Boone. Elmer, good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah. What have you got to say on this topic?
Well, it's a very hard thing to live through. It's part of I'm a recovering alcoholic, but it's like you know, you can walk into a room of people and still feel lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Can you tell me, Elmer, because there are people listening who perhaps in their life have never sensed this depth of loneliness for a long period of time. Everybody gets lonely once in a while, but we're talking about a prolonged chronic loneliness. Yeah. For someone who's never experienced it, what is it like, Elmer? You've experienced it.
It's like you realize that you are an individual and you would like to have something else there, but there's nothing else there. It's like a total emptiness. It's like hollow.
Mm.
It's something that I wouldn't recommend. Mm-hmm.
Daniel, what about Elmer's words there? How do you describe it when you look at it scientifically?
Well, one thing that we've looked at is, you know, are there certain personality characteristics which are associated with being lonely? And, you know, someone who's very introverted may have great difficulty, you know, making friends with other people, may feel shy, and that in turn may make it hard for them to develop relationships that they're really looking for, and in turn overcome loneliness.
So, Elmer, what do you do? Have you tried reaching out? What is the wall that you're hitting?
Well, actually, I have gotten past the wall. I quit drinking.
Mm-hmm. That helped.
And yes, it did. I've been recovered for a while, and it makes it easier to actually reach out and do it correctly. Mm-hmm. You know, to where when I was drinking, the reaching out was improper.
Okay, Elmer, very good. Thank you for sharing your story. And
sure.
Daniel Russell, where can someone go who's listening, who might find himself, him or herself, in Elmer's situation, wanting to break through? Tips on getting out of the chronically lonely category.
Well, I would, you know, in a situation like that, you know, joining something like Alcoholics Anonymous can be very useful. In terms of beginning to develop relationships with others. And, you know, there are individuals who've had to deal with many of these same problems. In terms of overcoming alcoholism or other forms of drug abuse, you know, developing better relationships with others, gaining support from others can be very helpful in overcoming those problems. In general, you know, there's with older adults, you know, getting involved in various kinds of volunteer activities seem to be a very positive thing to do, to meet other people with similar interests. So doing things such as that can be very helpful in developing friendships and relationships. And, you know, similarity matters. So, you know, ways in which you can develop relationships with people with similar interests to your own can certainly help you to develop relationships with them.
Daniel Russell is with us for this half hour, Iowa State Professor of Human Development and Family Studies and co-creator of the UCLA Loneliness Scale, finding that 35% of people over the age of 45 are chronically lonely. What does that mean? How do you tell us about the scale and how you qualify as chronically lonely? What are some indications?
Well, the scale, first of all, we developed it based on how lonely people describe the experience. And what we did initially was invited individuals to participate in discussion groups about loneliness and asked them to describe what this experience was like, you know, and you know, they would describe it as, for example, feeling a lack of companionship, having no one you can turn to, feeling alone. And the scale has a number of these statements, and it's what you're asked is simply, how often do you feel this way? And so the score on the scale is based on how frequently they have these feelings. There are also statements that reflect, if you will, not feeling lonely, such as feeling part of a group of friends. So, again, you know, we're trying to capture both feelings associated with being lonely and not being lonely.
Does a person who is lonely, chronically lonely, necessarily recognize that as such?
Oftentimes, I think they don't. And so, for example, you know, you can ask someone explicitly, are you lonely, or how often do you feel lonely? And they may say they don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. But they may get a high score on a scale like this. Because
so what would be a question, you besides that direct question, are you lonely, a question or a series of questions that might get at whether a person is lonely?
Questions like, do you feel left out? Do you feel isolated from others? Questions such as that.
Mm-hmm.
Along with some of these positive questions, such as do you feel close to people, in that if they don't feel that way, that may reflect a high level of loneliness. What we've found early on was that if you ask people explicitly, are you lonely, some people aren't going to admit to those feelings. And in particular, men aren't going to admit to those feelings. So when we asked people very directly, we would find that men reported lower levels of loneliness than women. But then, like on our scale, you tend to find no difference at all.
Okay. 1-866-780-9100. Looking for questions about chronic loneliness, also your experiences. 1-866-780-9100. How you cope. Let's go to Greg, who is on the road, I hope safely, communicating with us. Good afternoon to you, Greg.
Hi there.
Hi. What's on your mind as far as loneliness goes? Are you lonely? Have you been lonely in your life?
Well, I guess I've been lonely quite a bit in my life ever since. I'm 100% disabled from the military, and then I ended up getting divorced from my ex-wife, and so now I no longer have anything. I'm not as close as I was to my kids, but I feel like. Being as young as I am, I'm only 43, and everybody in my age group are working, and so, I'm at home, I do work part-time, but, I'm not working all the time, and so I sit at home, and, I don't have anybody to do anything with, and I am in a relationship now, but, just this past weekend, she went away for a weekend that she goes away for every year, and I sat around and had absolutely nothing to do and nowhere to go. And, my family doesn't even contact me, my immediate family. And, so I go out and I search, I feel like I go out and I have to search for people to have contact with. And it gets really, sometimes almost upsetting, that nobody will want to have any interaction with me.
Right. Do you find that your disability is also a barrier to interaction?
Sometimes because of my head injury, I've had a lot of other issues that go along with it. And for the most part, I find myself pretty easy to interact with people, but I have these hidden things that can, like my anger can, play a real part in that. And, my family calls me things that I don't understand why, but, I just feel like the things that I like to do and I, whether it be the outdoor things that I like to do, whether it be hunting and fishing, the only companion I have is my dog. And so I guess that's pretty much all I have to say, really.
Greg, we want to thank you very much for sharing your story. Greg, on the road, driving to Waterloo. Let's move up to Jim, who is, I see here on my screen, heading to Humboldt?
I'm driving between Humboldt and Pocahontas.
Okay, what's on your mind when it comes to chronic loneliness?
I wanted to talk a little bit about the issue of Asperger's syndrome. And how that might impact on that issue. I've been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, and I've gone through extended periods of very, very deep loneliness. And it always seemed to me, and I didn't realize this until later, that part of the problem with something like Asperger's, which for those of you who don't know is a very mild form of autism, is that apart from merely feeling lonely, you also have to figure out how the dickens do people interact, because interaction of and by itself doesn't always make a lot of sense as to how people interact.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if the researchers, the people here that you have as guests, had run across that.
Okay, let's put that question to Daniel Russell of Iowa State University. What do you think?
Well, certainly a number of disorders like that can create problems in terms of interacting with others and can create a situation where others may react to you negatively. And again, you know, the best solution, I think, is to try to seek out other, for example, support groups, other individuals who are in have similar problems, and that can help you both develop relationships, but also better understand the reactions of others to you. And so that can be, you know, a way in trying to develop relationships with others. Sometimes, you know, you may find it's better not to interact with others given the nature of their reactions to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that in of itself may make you feel worse, even if you do interact with some people.
With all the interaction going on over the internet, I'm wondering about modern life, the technology, primarily information, media, the ability to chat online and so forth. We can say, well, we can prevent loneliness that way, but also when you imagine someone who would normally go out and interact face-to-face with someone might hole up in a room and choose to interact online. So is there a difference? Has this technology increased or reduced loneliness in our society?
Well, some of the data that were in the AARP survey clearly indicated that, you know, interacting with, say, friends and family in person had greater benefit in terms of loneliness than interacting with people. Again, that it may not involve, you know, friends or family, but interacting, you know, trying to develop relationships over the internet may not be as have as great a benefit in terms of loneliness. Several years ago, we did a study here in a class I was teaching with some undergraduate students of, you know, and this was before things like Facebook were around. But looking at among college students, you know, who develops friends over the internet,
mm-hmm.
and clearly lonely individuals, shy individuals, are more likely to do so. So clearly people are using that as a way of trying to develop relationships with others.
How do holidays affect loneliness?
Well, that can make it very salient to you how your relationships have changed. So, for example, if you become widowed or, you know, your contact with family has changed, you know, maybe a close family member has died, you know, that can make that salient and lead to feelings of loneliness during a period of time,
mm-hmm.
Like Christmas.
So it might be a good time. Of course, that would be a natural reaction. But as a reminder, if someone has lost a significant other prior to these holidays, reach out and make sure that person is doing all right.
That's right. That's right. And the various groups, you know, so for example, church groups can be of great benefit to someone who's fairly isolated from family over the holidays. And you know, groups such as that, you know, should try to identify individuals who may experience loneliness over a period of time like this and reach out and get them involved in various activities.
Daniel Russell, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much. Iowa State Professor of Human Development and Family Studies, together with his wife, Carolyn Catrona, professor also at Iowa State University, chair of psychology at ISU, as a matter of fact. They developed the UCLA Loneliness Scale, which is featured in the new AARP, the magazine survey. Daniel Russell, I want to thank you very much for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
And The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And if you'd like to hear this program, perhaps you caught just a few minutes of it, didn't hear the whole thing, go to iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.